So I had an opportunity yesterday to watch the movie Noah with Russell Crowe. First of all, let me say that Russell Crowe is a great actor. I have liked him in everything I've seen. This was one of the worst movies I have ever seen. Ever. I can tell you about it because I want to spoil it for you. It's that bad. They had creatures, they called them the Watchers, and we've talked about the Watchers, right? Walking, talking rocks. It was horrible. I was expecting to see a great biblical depiction of Noah and the flood, and we didn't get it. How disappointing. But you won't be disappointed tonight as we talk about the serpent's promise. The retelling of the Bible through the eyes of modern science. My guest, Steve Jones, is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, science writer Steve Jones, professor of genetics at the University College London. He is a noted author, including The Serpent's Promise, which we're going to talk about tonight, the retelling of the Bible through the eyes of modern science. I've always been fascinated in the stories in the Bible and how you could look at science to see if we're dealing with one of the same. So this is going to be a fascinating couple hours. Steve, welcome.
Hello, hi.
And I hear you're way out there in the United Kingdom.
I am, and it's a lovely morning here.
The Serpent's Promise, science and the Bible. You know, when I was a kid and read the Bible, Steve, I looked at it, believe it or not, through the eyes of science, and I tried every facet of the Bible. I tried to include information about what would science say about this, what would science say about that. And you've done a great job with that. How did you focus in on that?
Well, I mean, I too, like you, when I was a kid, read the Bible quite a lot. I had a different experience from you because I grew up in Wales. I read it in Welsh, which makes it even more difficult than it is in English in parts. But it was obvious to me then, as I think it is to a lot of children, that actually what certainly the early writers of the Bible were trying to do were to ask questions about the world around them. And they were sensible questions. Where do we come from? Why are there men and women? How are they different? Are we born the way we are, or can we change ourselves? Who belongs to our tribe? All these questions really make a lot of sense. And there are a number of obvious historical events in the Bible. You mentioned that wonderful film, Noah. That's a really moving film. I moved out of the cinema after 10 minutes, I can tell you. And it's clear that the Noah legend reflects a real event. There really were a number of enormous floods in the Middle East, and there are flood legends, as all Christians know, that are flood legends that are much older than the Noah legend, and nearly all nations and cultures have a flood legend in the northwest of the U.S., for example, in Oregon and on the coast there, and the Pacific coast. There are flood legends which have to do with battles between whales and ravens. Now, we can track some of those down, the particular events, which are tsunamis, which are recorded in Japan. So clearly these things happened, and it just seemed to me that it would be a good idea to stand back from the conflict between science and religion, which is said to exist, and simply say, these are sensible questions. How can we answer them today with modern science? So that's what I'm trying to do.
Exactly. And let's tear Genesis apart for a bit here, Steve. And just in the beginning, when they talked about God creating everything within a certain amount of days, 6 days, rested on the seventh, and then the fallen angels. Let's look at science with that. With Genesis and the so-called Big Bang, which I, by the way, still have a difficult time understanding, how does that equate? How does that tie in together?
Well, I think they equate in a general sense. I mean, the Genesis tale, is actually quite a sophisticated account of how things might have come about because it has a series of events, one after another. And if you look at the thousands, or maybe even tens of thousands, of origin legends across the world, for nearly all of them, it happens in an instant. You're in the modern world, just like that. Okay. Now Genesis is more sophisticated. You have, you know, in the word in the beginning there was the word, and the word was God, and then you've got light, and then you've got mountains, and then you've got humans, and you've got males and females. So there is a kind of unfolding. But I think it would be foolish to say that is a prediction. Let's say the Big Bang. They're not the same kinds of explanation. It's the same kinds of questions, which is how do things begin. But the answers are not very similar. But there are a number of truths in Genesis. It's obvious, for example, sure, the idea of Adam and Eve. Now, when you think about it, it's clear there must have been an Adam, who was the male, the man, who was the ancestor of all men and women today, and there must have been an Eve, because if you go to your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, and so on, and to your mother, your grandmother, and so on, you end up, if you double up every time, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 ancestors, you very quickly run out of people. There aren't enough people to go around. So you have to go, as you go back, you end up with one male, who was the Adam for everybody, and mm-hmm. one female. But they were present among thousands or perhaps even millions of other people, and they had no idea that they were the universal ancestors. And in fact, certainly, they lived at different times and in different places. So in the general sense, you've got a truth. But in the literal sense, I think you'd be working a bit too hard to try and explain the precise story of Genesis in scientific terms, particularly, of course, as there are different versions in Genesis 1 and 2 of the tale.
Well, because clearly God did not physically create the universe and everything in it in 6 days. Now, logic will tell you that. Science will tell you that. Yet how do they explain that in Genesis? Why would they say it like that?
Well, I think, you know, you can argue, and people have argued endlessly about, you know, what did you mean by a day? Was a day a million, 10 million, 100 million years old?
No, that's a good
point.
That's
not really a scientific, that's a literary question. That's a theological question. And I think, you know, science is limited to asking answerable questions. And you can't answer the question, what was in the minds of the scribes who wrote Genesis when they were talking about days? My own guess, to be frank with you, is it meant 24 hours, days and nights. Now, I think it's clear that in that literal sense, that's not true. And I also think it's clear that with some exceptions, obviously, most believers don't believe with strict literality that it was 6 literal days. And I think it's possible to believe both of them. I mean, Genesis is a beautiful metaphor.
Sure.
And the Big Bang and so on is an interesting scientific story that might be wrong. And actually, as you probably know, there's now arguments about what the Big Bang was all about. So they're kind of parallel explanations, and they don't overlap. And I think it's a big mistake to mock the Genesis story because it doesn't do physics, or to mock physics because it's not in the Bible.
I agree.
That's a mistake from both points of view.
There's obviously some accuracy to both of them in that these events, I'm pretty convinced, have happened. From the flood to the Adam and Eve to you name it, to even the fallen angels, whatever they may be. It's just how they interpreted it and what science does to do it. So let's talk a little bit about the recollection of the authors of the Bible and how they put these stories together. Do you think, Steve, that, you know, somehow along the ages, I mean, how would they know about Adam and Eve in order to begin to write about it? What kind of knowledge came to them?
I think, you know, I mean, it's quite sophisticated knowledge. And you've got to bear in mind that the biblical story was written in an era of advanced civilizations, as indeed were most of the modern religious texts, the Quran and the like. I mean, these people weren't stupid by any means, and they knew quite a lot about the world. And it's an obvious question. The first two people you recognize in your life, obviously, are your mother and your father.
That's right.
And the Bible, of course, says, honor your mother and your father. And if you recognize your mother and your father, it's an automatic assumption, which is a widespread one, that there is a universal mother and a universal father. And you simply ask the question in that kind of almost sociological way. Is there a father, our father that art in heaven? Okay. Is there a father? And that's an interesting and valid question. Science can answer that in a much narrower way. It can talk about Y chromosomes, the chromosome that goes down the male line, let's say. And there's just different kinds of explanation. I'm not apologizing for science, and I'm not saying that religion is either bad or good. This is a separate issue. But they're the same questions with different but related answers is my view of an awful lot of the stuff that's in my book.
Now let's look at the Adam and the Eve, and you know you've looked at Darwin. As a matter of fact, you tried to rewrite it. We'll talk about that in a second. But so we look at the physical Adam and Eve, the Homo sapien, what we are today, and it obviously, if they were the first babies, the male baby and the female baby, they evolved from a different species where it started to change. I mean, the parents, let's say, of Adam and Eve, and again, I'm throwing out the biblical interpretation of how they got here. The parents, the biological parents of Adam and Eve, what do you think they were like?
Well, I mean, you can go back if you really want to. It's like when people talk about the paleo diet. What do you mean by, you know, who were our real ancestors? You can go back as far as you like. And the modern model is that life, in the sense of something that copies itself and divides and multiplies, began about 3,500 million years ago in a little warm pond, as Darwin himself said, probably a tropical ocean. And if you really want to, you can take our ancestry back to there and the ancestry of every other living creature, all of whom share the same genetic, more or less the same genetic material. But you can do that, ask it another way. You can make some calculations or guesses, to use the more honest word, about how rapidly genes change, and you can look at differences between males and females in DNA, and we can estimate, and it's a pretty wild estimate, that the universal father Adam may have lived about 100,000 years ago in Africa for sure, because we were in Africa then.
Sure,
and was a modern. What we call a modern human, looked like any other human being, okay. Eve, because far fewer men reproduced than women did, because lots of men didn't get mates, and most women had some children, Eve came from a much bigger group of people, so you have to go, of women, so you have to go further back, and she may have been 200,000 years ago. And she wasn't human, she was pre-human, probably a what we call Homo erectus now. And, you know, if Eve came and sat next to you on the subway, you'd definitely get up and move.
You wouldn't ask her out to dinner, would you?
You certainly wouldn't. And she clearly would look very different to us. The odd thing is that if Adam did, as an early modern human, you probably wouldn't notice. And now he might be dressed in furs and grunting or whatever would be going on there. But physically, the thing which is remarkable about species we belong to, most of us belong to, Homo sapiens as we call it, is how little physically in our bones, and also if you look across the world in our flesh and blood and our minds, how little we've changed over the 120,000 years or so that we've been on Earth. And the reason is, I'm convinced, is that actually what's happened uniquely to us, descendants of Adam and Eve, is that the arena of change for humans has moved from body to mind. And we really, that's really why we're the only creature, that's, as far as we can tell, that's got any kind of religious belief at all, because we have that unique human attribute of curiosity, of wanting to explain the world, which is what religion does and what science in a different way does.
How does science explain the biblical story of Adam and Eve formed from the rib of Adam?
Well, in fact, again, clearly that is not, clearly not true, because that's a story of what we call cloning or asexual reproduction.
Yeah. Okay.
Now we know that you can clone everybody. You listen to your program is a clone, in the sense that the vast majority of cell divisions that they've experienced, their body cells, and there are trillions of them, have been copies of the original fertilized egg, which is divided again and again and again, mm-hmm. for a few sex. But, and I have a sort of a rather unusual distinction, I have to say, which is not only am I a clone, but I'm the son of a clone, because my mother was an identical twin. and identical twins are those very rare things where an egg is fertilized and then it divides and develops into two identical humans. Okay, and it's interesting that in the early days of Christianity, there was a lot of argument about whether identical twins had souls, because there's only one soul. How can it be shared between two people? And some people thought that identical twins would burn in hell because of that. They weren't fully human. So that illustrates the differences, really. I can talk about cloning of humans to identical people. Theologians can argue about whether they've got souls or not, which can't answer with science. So I think that the literal cloning story is clearly wrong. We're not clones. We Adam and Eve did the first, and probably least original of all sins, which was to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge, and to, you know, gave them wisdom. And the first thing that used for their wisdom was to realize that they were male and female, and they put on aprons, and they had sex, and God was very, very annoyed, okay? And that's why they were expelled from the Garden of Eden. So clearly there's a tension there again. That's one of the other great attributes which we're curious about from adolescence onwards. What is this thing called sex? What's it for? Why is it fun? You know, what's the point of it? Can we control it? And it's clear that that's right at the beginning of the Old Testament, and it pervades nearly all religions. It's noticeable that when God speaks to his people in the Old Testament, and I think God gives his people 600 direct instructions of what you can do and what you can't do, what you should do. The first one is go forth and multiply. So really, it's at the root of all religions. Go out, have sex, and have children, and have children who belong to the faith you belong to. So they, again, science and theology, if you want to call it that, are marching in parallel. They're not overlapping.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about the theology of Adam and Eve. And they talked about, you know, the Garden of Eden and the forbidden fruit and the devil shows up. Where does science mesh with that, if it does?
Well, again, I don't want to milk the Bible more than that's in the story. But it's noticeable that when there are a number of interesting overlaps, really. When Adam and Eve are chucked out of the Garden of Eden, which is certainly somewhere in the Middle East, there's no question of that, probably somewhere in what's now modern Turkey, when they're chucked out and the next generation, Cain and Abel, appear, God says to them, I haven't got the exact quote and tip my tongue, but it says, by the sweat of thy brow thou shalt labor. Okay. And many people have interpreted that as reflecting a real historical event, which was that 10,000 years ago, in the Middle East and indeed all over the world, people lived as hunters and gatherers. And if you look at people, the very few people in the 20th century who still lived like that, it turns out that the people, and the common bushmen in the Kalahari Desert, actually had a pretty nice life. They lived in small groups, they killed wild animals, they took fruits and nuts and seeds off trees, and they had lots and lots of spare time, okay? So it's a good life. Then immediately, as the population grows, there's not enough food around. So you have to start tilling the soil with the sweat of your brow. Mm-hmm. Farming began about 10,000 years ago in the Middle East. And it's clear, if you look at the skeletons of early farmers, first of all, there was a population explosion, a huge increase in numbers, and you can see enormous evidence for that. And secondly, their health went to pieces. We live in an amazing era of good health in the developed world. I mean, I'm of a certain age. I'm 70 years old. And in my time at University College London, which is more than 40 years for my sins, I've seen the average height of young students go up by 1 or 2 inches from the
school. Hey, Steve, we're at a break. Hold on for a second, Steve. We're going to take this commercial break, and we're going to come right back with you as we talk more about the serpent's promise, the Bible interpreted through modern science. Fascinating. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back with Steve Jones in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Steve Jones as we talk about the serpent's promise, the Bible interpreted through modern science. And I'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're live in the United Kingdom with Steve Jones as we talk about his work, The Serpent's Promise. And Steve, we were talking about the devil factor with Adam and Eve and the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. As we've agreed, we think all these episodes in some form or fashion happened. It's the interpretation and how science looks at it. So for someone to write a story about the devil and the serpent, which is, of course, the name of your title, The Serpent's Promise, what do you think happened?
Well, I mean, I think, again, I don't actually think that a serpent came or an animal that crawled on its stomach came and offered a fruit, which it may have been a fig or an apple, or it wasn't a banana because that was in the New World, not the Old World. I don't think that literally happened. But I think that the dawn of knowledge, which is what that's all about, the dawn of understanding. The serpent said, "Eat of this. If you eat of this fruit, you will be like gods, knowing of good and evil." And the world is knowing, knowledge. And I think what that story reflects is the dawn of curiosity, knowledge, and understanding among humans. The desire to explain the world, and Adam and Eve, story, but the Old Testament narrative is simply a statement of that. It's an attempt to explain the world, and that's what we've been doing ever since, and that's what we now do with science. We may move back away from science one day, but at the moment it's doing rather well at explaining the world.
Noah's Flood. We both didn't like the movie, but it's a great story in the Bible. Obviously, something happened. I've tried, Steve, to think, you know, was it an asteroid that hit the planet and caused a huge tsunami that wiped out a certain region? I don't know what happened, but I'm convinced there must have been a flood, right?
Yeah, geologists actually know a lot about floods. And strangely enough, it's pretty clear, you know, as I think we said in the earlier part of the program, if you look across the world, nearly all civilizations north and south of the equator, particularly those near the sea, have got flood legends. And there are some tremendous flood legends in New Zealand, among native New Zealanders and among Australian Aboriginals. And some of which is just terrifying. The sea rises and roars over the mountains, killing everybody. Well, it turns out very much that if you look at the ocean bottom nearby, there is indeed two great holes in the ocean bottom, two great craters, which were asteroids, or they were rocks of one kind or another, which slammed into the ocean, generated these huge floods probably a couple of thousand years ago, and the legend of those floods has lived on. And what's interesting, if you look at the Australian story, that Aboriginals, if you go to the south coast of Australia, look across the seas from Adelaide, which is, I've spent some time, it's an ocean, but the Aboriginals have legends about what used to be there. And if you look at, if you take a submarine and you look and begin to track out the ocean bed there, actually their legends about the shape of the countryside, the land, are about right. So these ideas can last for years. Now the biblical flood, we don't know, but there is one claim, which is it has to do with the changes in sea level, which finally broke through again in Turkey through the Bosphorus, which is where Istanbul now stands, and broke through and filled the Black Sea, which is what's now the Black Sea, quite quickly as the Mediterranean, as the sea levels rose at the end of the Ice Age. It suddenly poured over, began to fill the basin of the Black Sea. People fled before it. Probably didn't fill it at enormous speed, but it filled it, and that idea lives on as one of the many flood legends. So I think it's reasonable to say there was a great flood, and reasonable to say, for example, other geological things we all know about Joshua and blowing his trumpet and the walls of Jericho falling. But the walls of Jericho falling were clearly an earthquake. The evidence is clear that there are lots of earthquakes there. And if there are earthquakes, there's often a great sound of rumbling, which could indeed have been a trumpet.
That's right.
So again, you can explain these things in these rather banal ways.
Sure. How do you explain the Noah family and the building of the ark with this flood myth that was worldwide?
Well, I mean, they're different. The idea that one man escapes or one family escapes is again common in Mesopotamia 1,000 years and more before the Nile legend. there is an almost exactly the same story of one king and his wife who escaped, Atrahasis, his name was. And quite recently, I was actually looking at yesterday, there's a new book out called The First Noah, I think it's called. And quite recently, some cuneiform tablets, some of these scratched clay tablets have been decided.
That they found
and
in Samaria.
And they give
Samaria.
You instructions how to build an ark, you know.
Yeah.
So if you want to build an ark, the way you do it, you make it circular. And so this idea of escape in the flood is common. And it, you know, again, it probably happened. Some people escaped. One of the things I found very odd about the response to the book is that a lot of believers, particularly on this side of the Atlantic, I remember having an argument with somebody on air about this, about the flood. And he said, well, the flood legend's got nothing to do with floods. And I said, what? And he said, no, the water's quite irrelevant. And I said, what about the ark? Oh, no, that's not important at all. And I said, well, what it was about? And he said, it's about the unique relationship of one man, Noah, with God, because Noah was favored by God. All the rest is just legend. And that I can't understand. I mean, I can certainly see
right.
It's about the relationship of Noah with God.
That.
But just to dismiss all the rest as legend, I'm in the odd position of not being religious, which I'm not, but apparently I believe more of the literal truth of the Bible than many believers do. And that I found quite startling. I didn't expect that.
The fallen angels, what the heck were they?
Well, again, it's the people who go against the rules. If you look at all post-farming religions, and we started talking about that, if you look at the religions of the early farmers, and the early farmers, there was a huge increase in numbers, a decrease in health, a decrease in human height, a great increase in inequality, and you begin to see defensive walls being built and that kind of stuff. And obviously, when you've got an enormous number of people, you need rules. And if you've got rules, you need punishments. And the worst punishment you can imagine is to be thrown out of heaven and to fall to earth and live in misery. So in my perception, and again, this is not precisely followed by science, although there is some evidence from modern religions that it could be true. But these people who are excluded from society because they don't follow the rules are scapegoats, okay? They're a terrible warning to others that you must do what society, and in the early days what the priesthood, tells you to do. And it's noticeable that that wonderful legend of the scapegoat, where the Israelites took a goat and loaded all their sins onto it and pushed it out of the desert when it died. That story comes from exactly the same time, or a little bit later, than the fallen angel story. And it's a bit of a more sophisticated statement of the same tale, is that religion, whether you're for it or against it, whatever religion it gives you a set of rules you have to live by, and by living through those rules, society is more homogeneous, it stays together at least for time, but if you break them, often the punishments are horrendous.
Moses parting the Red Sea, killing all the Egyptians as they chase the Israelites. Something probably did happen, right?
Well, that's an odd one, that one, because if you look at the details of that story, it's clear that the exodus from Egypt didn't happen. And the reason that we know that is that the Egyptians, the non-Israelite Egyptians, were clearly a highly sophisticated people, as we all know, from the pyramids and from later they kept careful records. We know a lot about the history of Egypt. We know a lot about the various towns and villages, the landmarks which the Israelites are supposed to march past on their years-long journey across the desert to the promised land. And it's clear that there was not a huge drop in population, which there would have been if it had been the hundreds of thousands of people on the Exodus. That didn't happen. Many of the way stations they were supposed to have stayed in had not yet been founded. So that particular story, I think, is an example of the Bible as metaphor. And it was written long after the supposed event, like a lot of biblical stories were, probably during the exile from Jerusalem in Babylon after the fall of the first temple. And the priests who were exiled to Babylon, what they wanted was a strong, powerful story in which they would go back to the promised land. And that turned itself into the Exodus story. So that's one I think most biblical scholars, I think, although I'm not a biblical scholar by any means, would agree that that's the case. This is a story of exile, but the details of where it was set are not correct. But The interesting thing which science does, of course, is that you can actually now, every one of us in our own DNA, we contain a complete record of our own historical movements. And by looking at DNA, as everybody knows, you can work out how people moved across the globe. And it's remarkable, really, that the very almost the first people, in a general sense, to have their DNA looked at in large numbers were Jews. There's a great interest among people of Jewish origin, and my wife, as it happens, is Jewish, is a great interest in descent, in what it means to be Jewish and the like. And so we know an awful lot about the movements of the Jewish people across Europe and across the world. And there are tales of exile there, which are in many ways more remarkable than the tales of exile in the Exodus. Famously, in AD 70, when the Romans attacked Jerusalem, large numbers of Jews fled. Many of them went to Spain and Portugal, where they stayed for a long time until 1492. Then they were expelled again and moved back off, many of them, some to the New World, many back to Turkey and the like, where they became Sephardic Jews. But if you look at the genes, the DNA of modern Spain, it turns out that a high proportion, about a quarter, of all the male chromosomes, the Y chromosomes of modern Spaniards, are of Jewish Sephardic origin. Huh. So the Jews left their history behind. And that's true all across the world. So the tale of humans as a nation of exiles is confirmed by modern biology.
One of the stories, of course, of the Bible, Steve, that fascinates me, Sodom and Gomorrah, I'm convinced that that area was probably hit by some kind of meteor or asteroid.
Well, again, that we don't know. It's clear that obviously a lot of sin going on there, and it's clear again that, again, as is the case with all religions, there's a great interest by the religious authorities, whoever they might be, in controlling human behavior, sexual behavior. And it's late at night, but we really shouldn't go into too much detail on what was going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. It wasn't what people think from the word sodomite. It probably wasn't that. But clearly they were being pretty naughty and they were punished for it. It's on that one of the worst sins you could do among the Israelites at that time was to have sex with or marry or mate with somebody who was not herself. It's only the men that mattered, of course. Somebody who was not herself an Israelite. It was a terrible, terrible stain to allow a mixture from other tribes into the Israelite tribe. And that was what seemed to be going on in Sodom and Gomorrah, and that's no doubt why they were punished. And that, again, is true in many religions. Not all of them, but by any means, but certainly true in some.
Of every depiction between the Bible and science that you were writing about in The Serpent's Promise, is there that one story that you found to be the most fascinating of all of them that you looked at?
Yeah, the one I really liked, which really hadn't struck me at all, until I started going into it, was the question of, you know, in Leviticus, which is one of the early books of the Old Testament, that's all about rules about, about cleanliness and about diet and all that kind of stuff, okay? Why was Leviticus obsessed with leprosy and disease, which he certainly was? Well, it turns out that Leviticus was written probably something like 3,500 years ago, and that was just the time when the first big cities were beginning to appear, Babylon being one of them. People were beginning to get together into biggish towns, beginning to move much more than they had before. And that's exactly when epidemic diseases begin. Now, we can see that in the modern world. You can see that with the Asian flu at the end of the First World War, with SARS, with the concern about bird flu today. What happens is that for an epidemic to get going, and epidemics can kill thousands and billions of people, you need a certain pool of people for it to burst into action, and you need people to move to carry the disease from place to place. And it's noticeable that in Leviticus there's a huge amount of concern about leprosy. Not quite sure what disease that was. It might have been leprosy. We find corpses with leprosy bacilli in them from that time. This is infectious. What's happening? We've got this new thing. It's never happened before. These horrible diseases, where have they come from? Obviously, they're God's punishment in one sense. But in fascinating terms, they mark the beginning of the era of epidemics. And if you look, for example, at Chinese history, when there was plague, they have detailed records over 2,000 years of the epidemics of plague. And they didn't get going until, once again, you've got reasonable-sized cities and people began to move. And we're now living in a dangerous world. We're living in the world of Leviticus because we're all linked. We've all heard about Ebola virus. That actually is curable if you get to it quickly enough. But I think people have every right to be concerned that we need to be clean, we need to be vaccinated, mm-hmm. we need to fight off. And that's what science is now doing, what Leviticus, in a rather sensible way, is telling people to do. If you are infected, you must go beyond the camp. You will be thrown out. You will be unclean. Now, that was unkind, but it was a sensible response. We have the same response now, which works better.
The fact that science can answer a lot of these theologian-type questions, does that mean that there is no God? Do you even go there?
No, I don't see that at all, actually. I mean, I myself do not, like that many scientists, do not believe in God.
Right.
But I don't not believe in God because of science. I just don't find it necessary. There was a great French astronomer called Laplace, and he was interested in the workings of the solar system. Okay, and Newton, the English physicist, had kind of worked out gravity and that. I mean, he was pretty smart. He wasn't French, so he wasn't really smart. But and yet he believed that, in spite of all his rules, that the solar system only worked because God had put it into motion. So Newton absolutely believed in God. And in fact, he wrote much more about theology, six times as much about theology as he did about physics. Now, Laplace did a bit later, and Laplace was asked by Napoleon, the famous Napoleon, who was an incredibly educated man, did mathematics and all kinds of stuff. Napoleon asked Laplace, why is there no mention of God in your book about the solar system? And Laplace replied, I have no need for that hypothesis. In other words, I don't need to have a God to make my mathematics of the solar system work. And that's kind of what I feel. But I equally feel that the mathematics of the solar system, or my expertise in genetics, doesn't say anything that there's no God. They're not related to each other. Religion and science, to me, there's often said to be a battle between them. Well, it's like a battle between a shark and a tiger. A shark's very powerful in the ocean. A tiger's very powerful on land. But if anyone strays into the territory of the other one, it's going to lose. And I have to say, historically, religion has tended to stray into the territory of science and deny the truth of science. And it loses. Science sometimes tries to stray into the territory of religion. And my friend Richard Dawkins, I think, sometimes goes a bit too far in that mm-hmm. direction. And I think we're bound to lose. If we say that science disproves the existence of God, I think you're just being silly. They're not related to each other. Science proves that the Earth isn't flat, fair enough. But that's the kind of boring stuff it proves. It doesn't prove anything about higher beings. It doesn't need them.
All right, Steve, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take phone calls with you. Steve Jones with us, The Serpent's Promise, the Bible interpreted through modern science. And, of course, as we've talked about, I've always wondered how they interpreted these. And if you look at it through the eyes of a scientist, you come up with similar but at the same time different interpretations of what may have happened. Steve Jones with us. We'll take your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.